Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's not all that often that I do fiction on the morning show, and so when I do, when I choose to highlight a novel on the morning show, you can bet that it is something that has grabbed my attention and, in a sense, stolen my heart, and that is certainly the case with a novel that I have been reading by Mary McNear. She is a best-selling author, and this latest novel, The Space Between Sisters, is, I believe, the fourth in a series of novels that are set on and around Butternut Lake in northern Minnesota. And it is a beautiful place from the vivid description we get, and there are very, very interesting people who live there. And they are people who are intriguing and yet ordinary. I mean, it's not like people who have been sort of fantasized into existence by a Hollywood script writer, but these feel like people that we might know, and yet there is nothing bland or not even particularly predictable about the people that we meet in this novel. The Space Between Sisters focuses in particular on two sisters, Wynne and Poppy, who love each other and yet who are diametrically opposites in so many, many different ways, which creates a very, very difficult relationship for them. And fold into that other complexities with other people, and you have the makings of a really, really terrific novel. I'm excited to be able to speak with Mary McNear, who has written with great distinction three previous novels that are along this very, very same line. And much of this is based upon her own growing up here in the Midwest. So I'm excited to speak with her about her latest novel published by William Morrow, again called The Space Between Sisters, a Butternut Lake novel. Mary McNear, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, well, Greg, thank you so much for having me.
So tell our listeners, first of all, where you are from originally and the ways in which this novel and the novels that precede it are at least some reflection of who you are and where you come from.
Well, I was born in Chicago, but my mother was from Racine, Wisconsin. And so during the Great Depression, her grandfather, my great-grandfather, had built a cabin on a lake in the northern Midwest. Now, in the novels, the town of Butternut is set in northern Minnesota. But my experiences were actually, as a child, and today, to this day, when I talk about to my friends about being up at the lake, it's actually a lake in northern Wisconsin. But the reason I set the novels in northern Minnesota is because you already have a Butternut, Wisconsin, right? Which you may or may not know. And we used to pass through Butternut, Wisconsin on our drive from Chicago to northern Wisconsin, and I always loved the name. But I didn't want to set the series in a real town because, you know, I wanted to have total freedom with the town. I didn't want to get a Facebook message from a reader saying, I was in Butternut, Wisconsin, there's no coffee shop of that name. So I thought, well, is there a Butternut in Minnesota? And it turns out there are three lakes called Butternut Lake or Lake Butternut, but there are no towns called Butternut. And I've been to northern Minnesota And I think most people who've been to both northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota would agree that it looks a lot like northern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So I felt like I could write convincingly about it.
Sure. Where exactly was the cabin that was such an important part of your childhood?
So, you know, they call that area the Hayward Lakes area. It's on a lake called Lake Owen, which is outside a town called Cable. So when I was growing up, my family lived in Chicago, but every summer we would load up the station wagon. Remember station wagons,
right,
Greg? You don't see those very often anymore, but we would load up the station wagon and we would make the drive from Chicago to Cable, Wisconsin. And of course, this is before the era of seatbelts. You can see I'm dating myself here. So I remember my sisters and I spending most of our time climbing back and forth between the front and back seats, which of course, you know, now that I have two children of my own, is the stuff of which nightmares are made, right?
Right, exactly.
But it was a different time, right?
And a long, long trip.
It was a long drive, but it was well worth it.
Right.
And of course, there have been a lot of changes in Cable since we started going. I mean, when I was a child, the road that the lake is on was unpaved, if you can imagine.
Hmm.
Now, of course, it's paved. And the last time I was in Cable, which was last summer, I decided that the latte I ordered at the coffee bar there was better than the latte I get at our coffee bar in San Francisco.
Whoa, there you go.
So if you're measuring progress in a latte, I would say Cable has more than arrived.
Wow. Well, and then this is an interesting reflection also then on two of your main characters, the sisters, that they are residing for this summer at their family's cabin, and it is a cabin to which they've returned many times and for them represents some of their happiest memories of days gone by. And it sounds like you have experienced something similar yourself.
No, I put a lot of me and a lot of my my sisters and our relationship with each other into this novel. I mean, I have three sisters, so it's interesting that it took me into the fourth novel to write about a relationship between sisters. In fact, the third novel features a relationship between two brothers, which, as you can imagine, is not something I know a lot about personally. So I really drew on my husband's experiences with his brother. But I think the subject was almost too familiar to me, Greg.
Hmm.
Also, you know, someone said to me once, what was it like growing up in a household where there were only girls? And I said, well, someone was always crying. That's my memory of it. We did not lack for drama. So I think that there was a part of me that thought, oh, do I have to write about this? But at the end of the day, yes, I did have to write about it. And I really needed to bring as much truth to it as I could. I mean, I want the Butternut Lake series to be escapist fiction in the best sense of the word, but at the same time, I want it to have, at its heart, I want it to have emotional realism.
Hmm.
So,
before we start digging into some of the specific characters and storylines of this beautiful novel, again, called The Space Between Sisters, I would love to hear a little bit about at what point in your life writing became so important to you. First of all, as a youngster, was this already something to which you devoted a lot of time and energy? And at what point did it really become, in a sense, a professional pursuit?
Well, when I was growing up, I loved to tell stories. And I used to basically force other children to listen to them, mainly my younger sister, my younger cousins, my younger neighbors. At a certain point, you know, I stopped telling them. And there was a part of me that wanted to be a writer, but there was also a part of me that just believed I was not brave enough to be a writer, that it took a special kind of courage that I did not have. And so I basically had just put that idea to rest. And I was in my early 30s. My husband and I were married. We had a 3-year-old son. I was in graduate school, pursuing what I hoped would be a responsible career. And our son was diagnosed with an autistic spectrum disorder.
Hmm.
So I realized very quickly that that I was not going to be able to finish my my PhD program, that it was just going to take something I wasn't going to have anymore, which you know, it was too intense. And so I was home full time with my son, and it was just really challenging, but more than that, really a terrifying time in our lives, because we didn't know how it was going to turn out. And I thought, you know, I spent all my time with my son, taking him to appointments, working with him at home. And, I thought, you know, I have to do something for myself, you know, even if it's only in a very limited sense, because I was starting to fear for my sanity. And anyone who's, I mean, it's something I think any parent can identify with, but particularly parents of children with special needs. So I thought, you know, I'm going to start writing a novel, and I'm going to try to work on it for an hour a day, which I know doesn't sound like a lot, but Greg, there were days when it was very difficult. And I remember one day, I spent an hour on it, but it was in 12 5-minute segments. So sometimes it was like an exercise in frustration. But the first novel I started, which was in the waiting room of the speech and language therapist I took my son to, actually, you know, eventually evolved into the first novel in the Butternut Lake series.
Hmm. As you began this, then, you probably did not have a particularly clear vision of where this could lead, or I'm assuming only in the vaguest sense.
It's true, because, you know, I think originally my focus was on I choosing something that I thought, writing in a genre that I believed I could publish in. So originally, I was not writing general fiction. I was writing very specifically romantic fiction, right? And of course, I still like to have romance in my novels, but that's not how I would define them, just, you know, by themselves. But I spent a long time writing romance novels, and actually it was a good way to ease into writing, because they're very, as anyone who's ever read one knows, they're very formulaic. So if you can learn the formula, you can write one. And looking back on it, I had a lot of fun with them, because you know, I wasn't taking myself seriously as a writer. I wasn't a writer with a capital W, you know, and I think that took a lot of the pressure off of me. But in some of those novels were sort of the germs of the series that would come later.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Mary McNear, best-selling author of a series of novels set in and around Butternut Lake. And the latest of these wonderful novels, the fourth, is called The Space Between Sisters. So I've not yet had the pleasure of looking at any of the previous novels, and I promise you, I really will before the summer is out. Although I'm not someone who reads fiction very much, but I really have loved this novel and look forward to exploring the others. But I need to understand, and I think our listeners as well need to understand, sort of the relationship between these various novels. I mean, I picked this one up, and I felt like I was not particularly at a disadvantage. I mean, it, in a sense, stands alone, and yet it isn't entirely alone. It has relationship with these other novels. Do they share characters or just the location?
You know, the first three are a trilogy, but even so, I wrote the trilogy so that you could either just read one of the novels in the trilogy, or you could read the trilogy out of order. I felt very strongly that, I mean, I think like a lot of people, I have read novels in a series before, and I've just picked up the latest one to be published. And, you know, if it's a good series, you can kind of, you know, figure out where you are in the series. But I really wanted people to feel like they didn't need to be handicapped by that. So the first novel introduces a character, Allie Beckett, who is a woman who whose husband died in Afghanistan, and she is now the single mother to a five-year-old son. So she moves back to her family's fishing cabin on Butternut Lake. And so we're introduced to several characters in the first novel who continue in the second and third novel. But again, I really wanted to bring a fresh perspective to each novel. So in the third novel, for instance, one of the main characters is someone who's new to Butternut. So we get to see the town through her eyes, which I think is always helpful, you know. You can almost get too comfortable with a character or a place if you don't continue to introduce new characters.
Sure. I think one of the reasons why I really enjoyed this novel as much as I did is because I'm actually not a huge go-to-the-cabin-on-the-lake kind of person. I mean, that's not something that, you know, my family, my parents didn't own a cabin. Although we did some of this up in northern Minnesota visiting relatives. But just this summer, my family had something of a reunion at the lake cabin of friends up in the Minocqua area in northern
beautiful,
Wisconsin.
Guys.
Absolutely gorgeous. And it was a really, really wonderful time. But as we spent the most of the family was there for basically a week. My wife and I were only there for about 3 days. But as we were kind of spiriting, you know, back and forth between their lake home and the town and so on, I was just sort of reminded all over again that there is a special sort of culture that tends to spring up in these kind of places. And I suppose part of it is kind of the strange mix of people who are there all the time,
yeah,
with others who drop in and out, and then others who are vacationing and so on. And it's such an interesting sort of, there's sort of a texture to the place that I think is unlike anything else that I can think of in America. And you probably know that even better than I do with all that you've experienced there.
No, that's true, Greg. And it's very interesting, too. I mean, I think one of the reasons why I think I chose to write about a small town is because I didn't grow up in a small town. I only spent my summers in a small town. I grew up in a city, and I today still live in a city. And I think that's given me sort of an outsider's fascination with small towns. You know, and I always, to this day, I mean, even though I've gone almost every summer of my life to this community in northern Wisconsin, I still feel like someone looking in, and I'm fascinated by it because, you know, one thing you quickly realize is that in a small town, everybody, they don't just know each other, they know everything about each other. But I also like to think about what they don't know about each other, because we all have secrets, even the most upstanding citizens among us do. And that's what I've chosen to write about in my novels, is what don't the people who live in this small town know about each other, and why don't they know it?
Hmm. And, of course, you also have the injection of characters who are genuinely strangers or newcomers about whom you know nothing about them, at least at the outset. And what do they allow you to know? And what is that process like where you sort of try to assimilate this newcomer?
No, you're absolutely right. And I have, for instance, in the first novel, the main character, Allie Beckett, when she moves to Butternut from suburban Minneapolis, St. Paul, she doesn't want to be assimilated into the community. She's really moving there because she wants solitude. She wants to get away. She's tired of being what felt to her like the object of pity among her friends and her family and her neighbors. She's really sort of tired of everybody worrying about her. And she thinks, well, if I go back to this cabin, then I can have some privacy. And, you know, my son and I can just live our lives. But, of course, what she doesn't realize is that she does get involved with the people in this town. You'd have to work very hard not to. And, of course, she's drawn into their world and ultimately is very grateful that she is, because we all need that companionship. We all need to be part of something bigger than ourselves.
Let's talk about the two sisters who in so many respects, sort of form the spine of this story. So much revolves around the relationship between Wynn and Poppy. And one of the compliments I want to pay to you is that I really appreciate the fact that these two characters are so drastically different from one another, and yet somehow it's not in a way that comes off as cartoonish, in the way that so often there'll be some television movie or something in which we'll have these siblings who are almost complete opposites, and they feel more like caricatures than real people. And I'm not sure just exactly how you've accomplished it, but these two sisters feel so authentic. I wonder if you could just say a word about the challenge of crafting this kind of dynamic, which happens all the time, and managing to do it in sort of a fresh and real way.
Well, you know, I think what interested me is looking at my family, at my sisters and myself, and realizing, you know, we all are product of the same family, and yet we all adapted to that family environment so differently. And so in Wynn and Poppy's case, they had a very chaotic upbringing. You know, they had a father who was not really one of those stable, you know, workaday dads. And then they had a mom who was very kind of self-involved in her own life. So really what they've done is adapt to the best of their ability to sort of a less than ideal childhood, right? And one of them adapts to that kind of chaotic upbringing by being extremely, she can be very controlling, she can be very neurotic and very rigid. And the other one, Poppy, has actually gone in a different direction. She's very free-spirited. She doesn't take life that seriously. She sort of leaves a trail of chaos behind her wherever she goes. But, I mean, I hope that I wrote about that convincingly, because the truth is that the same families do produce very different people. And I think we all have different defense mechanisms, if you will. I mean, none of us have had a perfect childhood, you know. Although, you know, obviously we've all had different challenges, and some of us have had more than others. But I think, to me, it's always been fascinating how the same families can produce such different people. And I wanted people to understand, too, that, you know, the thing I love about sisters is that they, in the best of all possible worlds, they're always there for each other. And even when Wynn and Poppy do go through periods of estrangement, even in this novel. But in some fundamental way, they get each other, even if they don't always get along with each other. And a big piece of that is because they came from the same family, they kind of speak the same language. They kind of understand why the other person is the way they are.
Right. One of the really kind of poignant sub-stories here is of the past of each of these two sisters. And for Wynn, who is the one who is the much more sort of organized and methodical, lives a tidy life in so many respects. Part of what perhaps has driven her to, she's always probably been that way, but what drives her to be even more so is the heartache of losing her husband when they were both quite young. And as she is thinking back to that marriage and so on, one of the things you point out is how, you know, for instance, her sister Poppy couldn't imagine why she was in love with this young man named Kyle, man that to her seemed to be so boring. I mean, steady and predictable and to the point of boring. Isn't that just the last thing that you would want in a life partner? And Wynn responds, Poppy, don't you get it? I want to be bored. I want to be bored out of my mind. Say a word about, that's just so interesting to think about how somebody could find that attractive in a mate and a good idea as a foundation for a marriage.
Well, again, so that's Wynn reacting to her very chaotic upbringing.
Right.
You know? And there was definitely, I definitely put more than a little of myself into Wynn. And I personally, Greg, have worked very hard to have a boring life. You know, this has been one of my goals in life. And by boring, I mean stable, you know. And again, I can't control everything. I obviously, you know, having a child with special needs definitely has added an element of, you know, initially it was very chaotic and very stressful. But I think that was my response to my childhood. And I think to me, that was always what I wanted, was just to lead. Maybe boring isn't the right word, but just to lead a very calm, predictable, orderly life. And I always tease my husband and say that you know, he did really kind of grow up in this very stable family. And I always say, you know, you show me someone who jumps out of an airplane for fun, and I'll show you someone who grew up in a family like yours. You know what I mean? mine was a little more challenging, as much as I love them.
Right. And of course, in the wake of Wynn losing her husband and all that they had together, one of the things that seems to sort of drive her means of self-healing is to try to exert the tightest of control over all kinds of details in her life, most of which don't particularly matter. Describe to our listeners, for instance, her relationship to her kitchen drawers.
Yes. Well, the novel opens, the first scene involves Poppy, but the second scene is centered around Wynn, and it's a Saturday, it's summertime, it's a Saturday night, it's like 9 o'clock, and she has just emptied out the contents of all of her kitchen utensil drawers, all four of them. And she has a very specific classification system. So now she's going to start refilling them again based on that system. And, of course, you know, what's amusing, I hope, about the scene is that they were already perfectly organized. So basically she's not going to accomplish anything. It's just going to come from her satisfaction in doing this task again. And I have to say that does not come from me, but I have a sister who is highly organized, and of course we tease her about it relentlessly, but that's exactly the kind of thing she would do. And not only would she do it, but she would enjoy doing it.
Right.
That would be fun for her, you know? So I put something of her into that scene.
And it's so interesting to think about, I mean, me for one, but her Gwyn's sister Poppy for another. The kind of person, on the other hand, who in their whole lives has never organized a kitchen drawer, not even once,
yes.
Let alone gone back to that same drawer and organized it and reorganized it time after time after time, and finding some sort of fulfillment in that.
I know. Poppy is very different, and I think so much of Wynn's life is a mystery to her. Like, the conflicts they get in are over things like, you know, Poppy leaving a wet towel on the bathroom floor. Well, what's the big deal, right? She says to Wynn, you have an entire closet full of towels, right? And they're all perfectly organized. What's one of them lying on the bathroom floor, right? But to Wynn, of course, that challenges, you know, her entire sense of how the world should be.
Right. And I think the other thing that's intriguing about a character like Wynn is that so often if that's not who we are, if that's not the way we live our lives, we tend to look at somebody like that who lives their life with that kind of attitude, with that sort of approach, and we imagine a life that is, in a sense, sort of bland, maybe largely empty and shallow, nothing beneath the surface, it's all about the surface and so on, never dreaming that maybe beneath that pristine surface there is deep emotional turmoil and maybe even torment that is driving it. I mean, something in a sense completely the opposite of what we see at a glance.
No, I think that's true. And I think the challenge of writing a character like Wynn is, you know, not everything they do needs to make them likable. But if you've done your job as a writer, they have to be fundamentally likable. In other words, you may not like her in the first scene you meet her in, but you will come to like her as you understand why she does what she does. And of course, for the neater reader, you may actively sympathize with her too. You know, so for those of us who are trying to control clutter in our lives, right?
Absolutely. Another thing that is interesting about the character of Wynn is that it is, at the time of this novel, it is 3 years since her husband died, dying of lung cancer, the age of 30, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right, Greg.
Never smoked a cigarette in his life. I mean,
no.
So this just upends every expectation that they had about the way life should be. And now she has people in her life, that is, Wynn has people in her life who feel like 3 years, it's time for her to be moving on, maybe in ways that she has not tried to explore before. And this is something, at least at first, that she's not sure she's at all ready for. I wonder if you could just say a word about handling this very sensitive matter of Wynn's grief.
Yeah, no, I know. And it's something, too, that I approached in the first novel. I mean, it's very different. Allie, who was a character in Up at Butternut Lake, was had a child. Wynn did not. Allie's husband died fighting in a war. Wynn's husband died of cancer. And I thought what was interesting, though, is how do they, you know, for anyone who's ever lost someone they love, how do we now make room for them in our lives? And there's a line towards the end of Up at Butternut Lake, the first novel, where someone says, you know, everybody deserves to be remembered. And I believe that so strongly. I think the question is, how do we remember them? What is the challenge? And how do we honor that challenge? And, of course, it's different for someone like Allie, who has a son. I mean, for her, there's the added responsibility. Not only does she want to remember her husband the way he deserves to be remembered, she wants her son to remember him and ultimately to know him, even if he can't know him the same way, you know, that he would have if he'd had more experiences with him. So with Wynn, there's a scene where, because she's so organized, she's saved everything from their marriage. So she has boxes of things like letters and postcards and even cocktail coasters from a little Irish pub they used to like to go to. So she saved all these things. And Poppy, of course, it's hard for her to understand this need to save and categorize and file things away. She refers to these boxes Wynn has as the marriage files. But there's a scene after they got in a fight where Wynn thinks to herself, you know, doesn't Poppy understand? It's not that she's trying to remember. It's that she's trying not to forget. So, you know, as someone who has lost people close to me, that's what I was thinking about in that scene. How do we keep a place in our lives for people who are not with us anymore? And how do we really give them their due, which I think is something everybody deserves to be remembered and appreciated. But I think it's hard to find that balance.
As for her sister, Poppy, we've already touched on some of what makes her so incredibly different from her sister. And I think you do a really wonderful job of giving us that without, in a sense, describing it. Or telling us about it. It's we see it for ourselves in the way that she lives, in the decisions that she makes. Right off the bat, in the very first chapter, where she is showing up at her sister's cabin. Her sister Wynn owns this family cabin now, and Poppy is showing up with a male friend, completely unannounced, with absolutely any warning whatsoever, and it seems not to dawn on her in the slightest that there could be a problem with that, particularly when the sister to whom she's dropping in on unannounced is someone like Wynn. It's just fascinating to think about someone, in a sense, so clueless, so optimistic, in a sense, leaving all sorts of wreckage behind them in the way that they've lived their lives.
Yes. Well, you know, that's why Poppy's character really, you know, as we learned during the course of the novel, she had a traumatic experience during her teenage years, and one of her ways of coping with it is through denial, basically. And we see that in her relationship with Wynn. And what I hope is humorous about the first scene where we meet Poppy and Everett, who's a young man who Poppy has asked to drive her, you know, up to northern Minnesota. She's very blithe and very, you know, just sort of chatting away and looking forward to seeing her sister. And he's the one he's never met her sister before. He's the one who keys in on the fact that she hasn't warned her sister that they're coming. She hasn't warned her sister that she's basically moving in with her. She has all her possessions with her. I mean, he sort of shares the reader's feelings of, oh my God, is she really doing this without even a phone call? But in fact, she is really doing it without even a phone call. And that's how she has lived her life. You know, she counts on her charm to smooth things out, but that's a lot to ask even of a sister to take you in on a moment's notice at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night.
Right. And I think one thing you've achieved with this character of Poppy that I also think is quite impressive is that we meet her and we are, on the one hand, driven insane by her. I mean, she is a maddening person. And we imagine if she were in our lives as an actual sibling or whatever, that she would drive us crazy. Even if we're not as sort of uptight as Wynn,
yeah.
She's the kind of person who would drive crazy just about any normal person.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow, we like her. And we understand how Wynn would love her. But I should think that's really tricky, to craft a character that will have all of these qualities that that on the one hand drive us crazy and yet somehow add up to somebody surprisingly likable and compelling.
Yeah.
Did you think consciously about that balancing act?
I mean, you know, Greg, I guess the best way to explain that is I hope that if I like a character, the reader will like them too. Maybe that doesn't always happen, and if it doesn't happen, it's a problem. But I think in this case, it did happen. And, I mean, I think we all know someone like Poppy. And the thing about people like Poppy is one of the reasons they've been able to survive in life, you know, at the same time that they've taken so little responsibility for themselves and their life is because they are charming. They do have other qualities that offset their irresponsibility. And I really wanted that to come through because the flip side of the kind of chaos that follows Poppy through life is that she's fun to be with, or that she can be fun to be with. And in Wynn's life particularly, fun is something that's in very short supply.
Right, exactly. So. And she at least to some extent, appreciates this. I mean, understands it to an extent about herself and appreciates the fact that her sister Poppy shakes things up. And I think that's where sometimes things are much too simplistic. When, for instance, we watch some kind of B-rate TV movie, is it so often these kind of contrasting characters, in a sense, live in emotional silos and the connection between them is negligible, and it's all about the contrast. And you seem as intrigued with the connection that exists despite the contrasts as with the contrasts themselves.
No, I think that's true. Oh, Greg, I love that term, emotional silos. I'm going to have to remember that. That is wonderful imagery. Greg, I might have to put that in a novel. We're not going to have any legal problem here, are we?
Not at all.
I hope not.
I think another real interesting moment in the book is when Wynne is describing sort of the chaos of Poppy's life and talking about how she by now has completely lost track of how many jobs that Poppy has had over the years. I mean, and most of them she's quit. She's not even been fired, but she just is so easily bored, and so many different places she's lived and so on. But that when she tries to talk to her sister about it, she is just masterful at changing the subject. And in Wynne's mind, Poppy is incapable of true introspection, that she doesn't seem capable of really examining this life that she's living, and that would seem to be one of the real points of estrangement between the two of them.
No, it's true. She's not an introspective person, and the reason she's not is because she's afraid to be. And so, you know, when I drew on that side of Poppy, who I say in one scene, Wynne is thinking about Poppy, and she says, you know, her life hasn't moved forward. It hasn't moved backward. It's moved sideways. You know, I mean, for instance, she's had many jobs, but the jobs have not represented any kind of progression. You know, they're all similar jobs. They're all jobs that she just, you know, her latest job when she's comes to the cabin is as a receptionist. And it's not that she's not intelligent, and it's not that she's not capable. She is. She just cannot seem to build on whatever's happened in her life. And I think actually, again, Poppy is someone who we have all met before, that quality in her. We all know people who are very bright and very capable, and, you know, at least in terms of their careers and their personal life, they don't seem to be getting anywhere. It doesn't add up.
I was just going to say, it's like all of these things they do don't add up to anything in terms of reaching some goal or to some culmination. There's sort of a scattershot approach to life. And as it turns out, in the case of Poppy, at least one of the reasons she is so much like that is because she is running from a trauma earlier in her life that we're not going to spell out, of course, here. We want people to read about that in the book. Can you just talk for a moment, though, about how tricky it is to create that kind of reality in the life of a character and you know, the challenge of choosing, you know, what should that trauma be and how should it be described and so on?
Well, you know, I tried to so when I decided that I wanted to write, I mean, my idea of writing the perfect novel is writing something that that someone will toss into their suitcase before they spend a week at the lake. But if they can't spend a week at the lake, because God knows we can't all do that, for instance, I'm not doing it this summer, then I want it to feel like they've spent a week at the lake. So mainly, I really want to write I guess, you know, I want to write escapist fiction, but I want it to have a core of emotional realism. So in each of these novels, I've tried to tackle something that is more serious, and that's something I may not have experienced it myself, but I know people who have. We all know people who have, who've lost a spouse, or, you know, in book two, who have... you know, there are lots of issues that I tackle there, but, you know, things like divorce or single parenthood or, you know, knowing someone or being related to someone whose life is affected by alcohol. So what I was trying to get in book four, get at, is the fallout from a traumatic experience, how that changes your life, but really how it changes the lives around you too, because as you said, we're not emotional silos. You know, our lives do bump up against each other. And what I was trying to see with Poppy is, what would you do if something terrible had happened to you and you didn't feel when it happened that you were in a position to ask for help or to tell anyone?
Right.
So really a lot of who Poppy is has become is part of her coping mechanism. The problem is, during the course of the novel, it really stops working for her. She realizes, she kind of bumps up against it and realizes that if she is going to finally move forward in her life, she's going to have to confront it.
We should also mention that there are lots of other intriguing characters in this book. We've already mentioned Poppy's friend Everett. We've not yet mentioned the character of Sam, who is a recently divorced man living at Butternut Lake with his three children, his ex-wife, a successful attorney back in the Twin Cities, and they have achieved a remarkably amicable divorce, actually. But in the meantime, Sam is the parent during the day for his twin boys and little girl. And I think you so beautifully describe that gauntlet, how difficult it is for him to be the parent that he desperately wants to be to his three children. Can you just say a word about crafting this character in such a vivid way?
Well, I think what interested me about Sam is I don't think when he got married and started a family that he ever saw himself doing this. I mean, I think he was always going to be the kind of husband who pitched in, you know, but I don't think he ever thought that he would, you know, that basically he would be it. He would be the first line of defense with three young children. But I think what really fascinated me about it was, you know, he understands his relationships with his sons. He has 9-year-old twin sons because he grew up in a family of boys, and also obviously he's a man. So for him that makes sense, but he also has a 6-year-old daughter, and she is in many ways, even at 6, she's already a mystery to him. And I think what he's really trying to do in his relationship with her, sometimes it almost feels like navigating a minefield. You know, the first scene of him is he's trying to watch a YouTube video on his laptop. And, of course, we don't at first know what it is. Is it some kind of risque video? But, no, it turns out, we find out that it's a video of someone teaching you how to French braid hair, because this is something his daughter would like done. And, of course, he's never done it before. And, you know, it's a running joke because it turns out, I actually learned this as a mother, for some people, it's almost impossible to do something like that. And so he sort of struggles with the parenting a young daughter. And yet at the same time, he's really good at it because I think he observes the first, you know, the most important rules of parenting, which is just to be, you know, open to her and respectful of her. And also, you know, it helps that she's, of course, completely adorable. Let's face it, most 6-year-old girls are pretty cute.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes, and I really like how this small family is not quite saccharine, but very, very sweet. They are a family we enjoy spending time with. In fact, all the characters in this book, including the ones who are a bit less pleasant, are still interesting, and there isn't anybody or really anything about this novel that is in the least bit boring. Are there going to be more Butternut Lake novels?
So there's definitely going to be at least one more, which I'm writing right now. It should be published in May of 2017. And I hope, of course, that there will be more Butternut novels beyond that. But this will sort of complete the first 5 novels in the series.
This book, again, is The Space Between Sisters, a Butternut Lake novel, the 4th such novel in terms of this locale, and published by William Morrow, the author Mary McNear. Mary McNear, this was a great pleasure for me, not only to read your book, but to talk with you about it on the morning show. And it's especially fun to connect with someone with ties to this part of the country. And we look forward to more of what you are going to write. So thank you again for this time on the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Mavis Hymes, the author of a really intriguing book called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called. Also, I'm going to play more from my interview with Dr. Steven Ungerleiter. We heard from him about an Olympic documentary looking back at the tragedy of the Munich Olympic Games. From another portion of our conversation, we will hear about the memorial in Munich that is designed and being constructed to memorialize the athletes and coaches murdered at the 1972 Olympics. That will also be part